Jim approached me, it must be about a year or so ago, about this exhibition that was going to go on. And he asked if I could come in and give a talk about the science of meteorites and also about some of the uses that they have. And so I thought, well, meteorites in science and in culture. And so the first thing I did was I wrote a poem, which I sent to Matt, which he rejected for the leaflet. Didn't you, Matt? My poem, some would call it a limerick, but I call it a poem, was, there was a young sculptor called Matt, whose meteorites made him look fat. So he hammered and ground until they were round, and now he looks nice and flat. And he wouldn't put it in his leaflet. So that's a cultural bit. So I'm just going to talk about what a meteorite is and what we can learn from them scientifically, why it's important to study them, and then go on to meteorites in culture and the different things that people have done to them. And then something I added late on, actually, while preparing the talk, was meteorites in commerce, which is, you know, I thought it's, you know, important to address that as well. So first of all, what is a meteorite? Well, basically, they're natural objects that fall to Earth from space, and there are about 40,000 tons of them fall every year. Now, fortunately, they don't all fall as one big mass, because 40,000 tons all in one go would be pretty catastrophic. Most of it falls as dust. Practically all of it falls as dust. There are about 1,000 or so football-sized meteorites that fall on the Earth every year. But most of them are lost, right? Because they fall in the sea, they fall in deserts, mountains, or they fall in your back garden while you're asleep, and they fall behind a bush and you don't see it, you don't notice it. So most of them are lost. Only about 10 to a dozen are seen to fall and then reported. And that's a very important difference that we make when we're studying meteorites, because a meteorite that is seen to fall has slightly more scientific value than one that is found, because something that's been found, it might have been rained on and sunshine and showers and snow and ice, and they get weathered, they start to rust, just like terrestrial rocks do. So a meteorite that's picked up straight after it's fallen has none of those contamination problems. And they fall completely randomly. You can't predict where they're going to fall. The nearest one to Oxford fell at a place called Launton, which isn't far away from here, and it fell, I think, 60 or 70 years ago. I can't quite remember. And so they're named after the place where they're found, where they seem to fall or where they're found. And so if one fell in the road out here, it would become the Oxford meteorite. So meteorites have got, you know, when you look at a list of meteorites, it's like looking at a gazetteer, because they're from all over the world. And there's a couple of points that really it's important to stress about meteorites. They're called a meteorite when they land. Meteors, or shooting stars, are very small grains, salt-sized, sand-sized grains, that burn up in the atmosphere. So they're some of the dust, some of the cosmic dust, that actually burns up. So when you see a shooting star, it's like it's gone, and it's burnt up, and nothing lands from that. So a meteorite is something much bigger. It might make a fireball, and it gets enormously hot on the outside, incandescently hot, which is what makes it seem like a fireball. And as it comes through the atmosphere, it's the friction of the atmosphere that's making it hot and melting the outside. But as it tears through the atmosphere at, you know, 70,000 miles an hour or something like that, that surface, the molten surface, gets stripped off and you get a sort of fiery tail. And it gradually comes through the atmosphere, and then eventually it's not travelling fast enough, it gets slowed down. It's not travelling fast enough for the friction to melt the outside surface anymore. So the final surface, which is my little arrow. There we go. On the outside there, if you can see, it looks burnt. Now, that's the last bit that was hot, and it quenches, and you get a glassy outside surface. But you can see the inside of the meteorite is not changed at all, that pale greyish colour. So the heat does not get conducted inside. So the inside stays completely unchanged, and the meteorite is cold when it lands. So the stories we get of people who've seen meteorites and, oh, it fell and it set fire to my lawn. It's like, no, there's a bit of imagination at work there. And so this last bullet point here is classification of meteorites, encapsulated, all right? Some are made from stony material and we call them stones, and some are made from iron and we call them irons. All right, so there you go, meteorite classification, sorted. Actually, there is a third group, and that's those that are a mix of stone and iron, and we call those stony ions. All right, so, you know, again, nice and fairly simple. So I've got a picture. This one here is a stone, and it's made from the same material. It's, I suppose, one of the most similar rocks is basalt, okay, although they're not... most of the stony meteorites that we have haven't been melted. Here's an iron one, and this is a stony iron. So they're the three main types, and I'll tell you much more about them as we go on. So that's a little bit of background about meteorites. Why is it important to study them? All right, so we can learn a huge amount of stuff about them. We can learn about the origin and evolution of the solar system, and we can learn about how planets have formed and evolved, our moon, and we get a lot of extra information about Mars. We can learn about the origin of life and the universe and everything, as it says there. We can talk about stellar evolution, and we can learn about galactic evolution. Not necessarily in that order, and I'm definitely not going to talk about all of these things tonight, because it would take far too long. One of the background things that I did forget to say, though, is that practically all meteorites, and there are about 40,000 of them that we know about in all the world's collections, practically all meteorites have come from the asteroid belt, so which is the bit of the solar system between Mars and Jupiter. So most meteorites have come from there, but we do have a handful that have come from Mars, and we do have a handful that have come from the Moon. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about what we can learn from unmelted stony meteorites, and I'll talk about what we can learn from the metal meteorites, and then go on to the cultural bit, if that's okay. All right, so first of all, stony meteorites. Right, this is a fist-sized meteorite, and you can see on the outside there, that dark matte coat, that again is its fusion crust, the bit that was once heated but has now quenched. This big thing here that looks a bit like a bird dropping isn't. It's the same as these little things here, all right? So they're irregular inclusions or clasts within this meteorite. And as well as these whitish things, there are round things in here. In fact, almost all of this is made up of little round things. And the little round things and the white irregular things are held together by very fine-grained material, which we call the matrix. So it's a bit like a fruit cake, with the sponge bit is the matrix, and the fruit cake has got cherries and sultanas in it. So we've got a matrix with angular fragments and rounded fragments. Now, if you know anything about terrestrial rocks, we divide those into igneous rocks that have been melted and come from volcanoes and things, sedimentary rocks, which are made of sand or limestone that's been deposited in water, shale, which is from plants which have and trees which have died and then become compressed in deeper water. And then we have metamorphic rocks, which are either igneous rocks or sedimentary rocks, which have been heated by pressure and temperature. You can't categorise meteorites as igneous, sedimentary or metamorphic. They don't fit into that classification. They're not metamorphic because they haven't been altered by heat and pressure so much that they've changed composition. they're not sedimentary and that they haven't been produced by deposits in water or by deposits in sand. And they're not igneous. These particular ones are not igneous because they haven't been heated and come out of a volcano or something like that. The closest we can get is to call them a cosmic sediment. So sedimentary rocks are mixtures of all sorts of things. These are mixtures of all sorts of things. And the two main things that they're mixtures of are the irregular white aggregates and the little rounded things. Well, the irregular aggregates are called calcium and aluminium rich inclusions because they're rich in calcium and aluminium and they're included in the rock. You see, we do like to keep things very, very straightforward. And this picture here is a cut through a surface of a rock showing one of those inclusions. And it's been cut and polished, so it's only 30 microns thick, so that the light can actually shine through it and you can see its shape. And one of the first things you can see about it is it's got a very irregular shape. It's not rounded. It's very, very irregular in shape. And that immediately tells you that it's not been melted ever. All right, it might have been heated a little bit, but it's never been melted. It's kept this irregular shape. Now, calcium and aluminium-rich minerals are very, very refractory. I mean, you can't melt them. So if you can think of old-fashioned electric bar heaters where you've got wire wound round a ceramic former, that former will be made of calcium and aluminium minerals. So things like the inside of furnaces are made of minerals with calcium and aluminium because they don't melt until tremendously high temperatures. Now, the corollary of that is that they don't condense they condense at very high temperatures. So these bits in the meteorite have actually been produced at very high temperatures, about 1500 degrees C, about 1800 kelvins. So they form very early on when parts of our solar system were still very, very hot. Because our solar system came from a cloud of gas and dust that was part of a molecular cloud, and that gas and dust started to collapse. And some of it was very hot because it was heated by radiation and by pressure. And as the temperature of that cooled, some of these things formed, and they're rich in calcium and aluminium. The other thing that was in that rock, the grey rock, is these little rounded droplets, and they're called chondrules. And that comes from a Greek word, chondros, which means droplet. And they're made of iron and magnesium. So they're not made of calcium and aluminium, they're made of iron and magnesium. And we've got here again thin sections of them taken with a microscope. So this is just taken in ordinary light, and this is taken in light that has sort of had a Polaroid filter on it. So that's like putting on a pair of Polaroid sunglasses. And what you can see here is you're starting to be able to see the structure in these rounded droplets. And they've been formed by flash heating. So not a really long duration heating, but like a bolt of lightning, something like that. So there was a lot of lightning, because there's a lot of electric charge as the nebula was collapsing. And so there were bolts of lightning, there was all sorts of the dust grains were colliding with each other, and these might have been formed a bit like raindrops, two raindrops colliding and getting another droplet. So these formed at slightly lower temperatures than the calcium and aluminium rich things. And so we're starting to look. These are the building blocks that the solar system was made from. But you can start to disentangle different sort of eras of solar system history when you look at the different components in the meteorite. So the stony meteorites, because they haven't been heated and melted completely, they're telling us about the original dust that the solar system is made from. The iron meteorites, on the other hand, have been melted completely. So they've come from the same sort of dust, and that dust had iron in it, and it also had oxygen in it. And so you had iron silicon oxides, and there was carbon in the dust and sulfur and all sorts of things, and some of the dust aggregated into planets. The planets, hot in the middle, just like the Earth, got very hot from its size and from decay of radioactive isotopes. And as the dust got hot and started to melt, it started to become reduced in the same way that iron oxide is reduced in a furnace in steel making. So you take iron ore and you add coal to it, and also possibly sulfur, but mainly coal. Heat it all up, and what actually happens is the coal takes the oxygen away from the iron oxide and leaves iron metal, which falls to the bottom of the furnace. And this is what's happened in some of the asteroids that have got cores, and also in the Earth. It's got so hot, you've got reduction going on, and a metal core forms. The metal goes to the centre, so the Earth has a metal core. And that metal is mainly iron, but it's also got significant amounts of nickel in it. It's also got silver, gold, platinum, palladium and iridium in it, all those really precious metals. So the crust of the Earth, the bit that we stand in, is depleted in all those precious metals. They're all tucked nice and neatly away in the core where we can't get at them. I mean, the crust has got some, but not a huge amount. So the fact that there's nickel in these meteorites gives them a really interesting texture. And this texture is called the Widmann-Statten pattern. And it comes from the fact that as the metal cools down and tries to solidify, it's cooling at a very, very slow rate, about 1 degree, 10 degrees every million years. So metal in a furnace cools, you know, overnight to solid metal. So, you know, hundreds of degrees a minute or an hour. So these have cooled very, very slowly. And as they cool, you've got iron atoms, or ions, and nickel atoms. And they try to, they're almost the same size, but not quite. And they try and sort of move apart. And you get patches where you've got more iron, and patches where you've got more nickel. And when you get to a temperature of about 800 degrees, they don't have enough energy, they can't move apart anymore, so you've got this structure locked in. And when you polish the meteorites and etch them, you get this beautiful pattern, which is characteristic of iron meteorites. And this is what makes, this is what draws people to iron meteorites, because you can see this pattern in them, and you just don't get that in terrestrial rocks. Now, the picture on the right-hand side here is a type of meteorite which I am not going to talk much about at all, and these are stony irons. And what you've got is you've got the same metal that you have in iron meteorites, but those yellowy-green bits, they're silicates with iron and magnesium in them, like you get in the stony meteorites. But these are sort of bigger, and they're more like... they're called a mineral called olivine, which is also known as a semi-precious gemstone peridot or peridot. And this particular piece here has been cut, so it's only a couple of millimetres thick and polished. And when you shine light through it, you can see, you get a lovely effect of these olivine grains. And these are stony irons, and they're from the boundary between a parent body that's got a metal core and a stony crust. And what's happened is some of the metals come up and engulfed part of the stone and sort of brought it back. And then they've cooled, so they're from a core mantle boundary. They're the rarest type of meteorites. They're very interesting for scientific purposes, but they are very, very beautiful. They're stunningly beautiful, and many collections will try and get at least a small piece of a palisite, they're called, because they are just so lovely to look at. Okay, so I think this is the last bit I'm going to talk about in terms of iron and stony meteorites, but this is just, and I think this is one of two graphs that I've got, and it's just to give you an idea of what we can learn about when it comes to evolution, and actually how surprisingly precise we can be when we're looking at dates. So people might say, oh, the sun, it's about 5 billion years old, about 5,000 million years old. Well, it's not. It's about 4,567.2 plus or minus 0.6 million years old, right? Because that's the age of when those calcium aluminium rich inclusions formed. So that's this here. I like to call that the year dot, because that is it with its error bars on that you can see. This is the age of those round things, okay? So they formed a little bit after the CAIs. And then after that, you got the formation of the Earth. And then when the Earth was more or less finished, you got the formation of the Moon. And so practically all our solar system was in place by about 4,455 million years ago. And here in Oxford, you've got one of the biggest groups, well, not just in the country, but in the world, studying these things. And I think there's possibly some people here from that group. So looking at the age and the dates of meteorites. All right, so just three other short topics and then I'll get on to the cultural bit. So far I've just talked about stony stuff. What the stony meteorites also carry in them, and they're in the asteroids, which are their parent bodies, and they're also in comets, which are a very important part of our solar system. They carry a lot of organic material, carbon material, and they carry a lot of water in them, especially comets, which have got stony cores with with a lot of ice mixed in them. And this is a picture of Halley's Comet, when it came round in 1985-86. And some comets come round regularly, so this one comes round every 76 years. There are a lot of comets that come through the solar system. We constantly underestimate how many there are because we just don't see them. But if you look at footage of the sun, that some of the satellites, some of the spacecraft orbiting the sun have taken pictures, and you just see the number of comets that are actually falling into the sun. It's an incredible amount. So these comets and asteroids that carry water and organic compounds, they were bombarding the Earth when the Earth was forming. And they were bombarding the Moon and Mars and Venus. And they were spreading, they're carrying water and organic molecules. And they had two effects, it says there. Early bombardment of the Earth kept the surface of the Earth molten and it prevented life from getting going. But then gradually, as the sort of solar system settled down into its the geography that we've got today, this bombardment slowed down and the surface of the Earth gradually solidified. And then, because although there was still bombardment and it wasn't happening as often, organics and water started being added to the Earth. And we don't know today how much of the water that we have on the Earth was added by comets. But because it's all recycled, you know, it's like you have the sea, it evaporates, makes clouds, it rains, forms rivers, runs back into the sea. It's a cycle. So every glass of water that you drink, you have actually got in there some water that's come from a comet. We don't know how much, and we're not going to know how much until a mission goes to a comet, a mission called Rosetta, which will arrive in 2014. And that will take some measurements of the surface of the comet, which will help us to understand. It's going to be looking at the amount of deuterium and hydrogen in the cometary ice. And we can look at the amount of deuterium and hydrogen in our own water on the Earth, and we'll be able to get a mass balance, right? So the water, a lot of our oceans were added by comets, we don't know how much, and a lot of the building blocks of life were added by comets. I'm not talking about bugs from space here, I'm talking about just the building blocks. And the more we study meteorites, the more we understand about these things. So 40,000 meteorites in total, about 40 of them come from the Moon. And this is a picture of one of the meteorites from the moon. This is the first one that was identified. It was identified in 1980, well, it was collected in 1981 and identified in 1983 as being from the moon. And it could be identified absolutely as being from the moon because we've got the Apollo samples to compare it with. And this, you can see quite a white mineral here and class, all these clasts. These are different from the white stuff that was in the other meteorite. But if you look at the moon on a clear night, it looks nice and silvery. And it's the light shining off the silvery mountains. And this is what I was taught when I was doing geology many, many years ago. Our petrology lecturer said, when you are outside and it's romantic, and you and your loved one are looking up at the moon together, you can tell your loved one, it's the light shining off the feldspathic highlands. And it's like, yes, I do that frequently. But yeah, so that's what it is. So it's a particular type of mineral in the moon rocks. And so we could compare the meteorite with the Apollo samples, because we all know that the Apollo astronauts went to the moon and brought material back. We all know it wasn't just filmed in a garage somewhere in Houston. So we can say absolutely. And because they're from different parts of the moon, they've got characteristics in common with the Apollo samples, but some of them are slightly different. And so we can learn more about the diversity of rocks that there are on the moon. Now, Mars is slightly different. Again, we have 40 samples that have come from Mars. And nobody's gone to Mars. We've got plenty of spacecraft that have been to Mars, and some of them have landed safely, and some of them, like Beagle 2, failed to land. But we do have 40 meteorites from Mars, and the reason we can be sure of that is that these rocks have been broken from the surface of Mars by impacts. So an asteroid came down, hit the surface of Mars, and rocks were thrown out from the surface. And some of those landed on the Earth as meteorites. And in the instant that they were blasted off the surface of Mars, they trapped Mars's atmosphere in them. And there are little pockets that you can fertile out of these meteorites, and you can melt them, and the gas that comes out has got the same composition as Mars's atmosphere. So we can be sure as we can be that these rocks come from Mars. And so having decided that, we can then go and look at them and to see what we can learn about Mars. And in 1996, Dave McKay and his colleagues published a paper where they'd found in one of these rocks from Mars, a rock called Allen Hills 84001. It was found in Antarctica in the Allen Hills region in 1984, and it was the first one in that field season to be examined when the rocks came back to Houston. And in that rock, there are these patches. This is about half a millimetre across. And these patches are of carbonate, the same sort of stuff that makes up limestone. And this is an ordinary picture taken in a regular microscope. This one is a picture taken of the broken surface of these carbonate grains, and it was taken in an electron microscope. And Dave McKay and his colleagues found this little structure here, which they think looks like fossilised bacterium. It's only a few hundred nanometres. It's about a micron long. And so they thought it was a fossilised bacterium, and they published a paper saying they found evidence for fossilised life on Mars, fossilised Martian life. And lots of people don't believe them, still don't believe them. And there's a huge amount of work going on. But what this study actually did was it propelled the idea of looking for life on Mars. It gave it some sort of scientific respectability. And some of us have been working on that and trying to maintain scientific respectability ever since. But we study these Martian meteorites and the inclusions in them, not just to look for life, but to understand the temperature and the composition and the amount of water on Mars's surface and when it was there and what it did and things like that. Okay, so that's meteorites in science and a gallop through the various different things that we can learn from them. Turning to meteorites in culture, that's almost as varied as what you can learn from them about science. But it's not so much learning about these objects, but actually observing them and seeing why they are there where they are. And for many hundreds, thousands of years, meteorites were regarded with superstition, and it wasn't until the very early 1800s, the turn of the 19th century, that meteorites were recognised as being natural objects and true phenomena that could be studied. Prior to that, they were regarded as gifts from the gods, harbingers of catastrophe, often in the same way as comets were. They were collected, and most of the artifacts that have been found are actually metallic, because the iron meteorites look very, very different from the stony meteorites. So stony meteorite, you know, you're not going to pick it up because it looks different. But an iron meteorite, especially if one has fallen, you know, where you haven't got very many rocks, they were regarded as gifts from the gods. And sometimes they were just sort of, oh, crikey, you know, we can't do anything about that. You know, it's an object, we have to leave it there. But sometimes they were worked and they were used. And so I'm just going to take two examples of artifacts. And the first one is, actually I should have done the other one first, but these were allegedly found in Zhenjiang in China, found in 1931. And the meteorite community that names meteorites gave them the name of Wei Hui Fu A and Wei Hui Fu B. And I'm not abundantly certain why they gave them that name, because they could have given them Zhenjiang or they could have given them Hunan, but they gave them those two names, A and B. And they were found in tombs that date to, as it says up there, the Western Zhou Dynasty, 1050 to 771 BCE. And the one on the left is, whoops, here. They're a few centimetres across. And you can, I'm very, 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 very bad at these things, actually. I've just stolen these pictures from the Freer Gallery. So that's where they are. They're in the Freer Gallery in Washington. And it gives you their dimensions and everything. But they're a few centimetres across. And so this one is the axe, the chi, with dragons and masks. And this one is the dagger axe. I don't know whether that's the G or the gay. And this is a fragment, and it's been broken. And they have got the most marvellous intricate carving on them when you look at them. But they've got this greenish patina where they've obviously started to rust. But they haven't completely rusted away. And they certainly haven't lost the carvings that you can see on them. So they're not completely of meteoritic iron. And this is the interesting thing about most of the artifacts, is that they have been mixed with terrestrial iron. And then they're oxidised. So what it means is that these people were starting to work things perhaps earlier than we'd anticipated. And that's especially true of these. Now, I find this fascinating, and I'm afraid this is the best picture that I could get of them. These are even older than the Zhenjiang meteorites. And these are from Gerzeh, which is a cluster of tombs just south of Cairo. I have no idea what SD 60 to 63 means. I think it's a something dynasty. But they're from 3300 BCE, and they're worked. And so this is, it's believed to be one of the earliest examples we have of worked iron. And these pictures are taken from this paper by Wainwright from 1912, the Revue Archéologique, and you know, it just shows that these days, you know, electronic libraries and e-journals are absolutely magnificent. You know, the resource that's there for us to use. And these specimens are in the Petrie Museum at UCL in London. And I've got a colleague, I've got a colleague, Diane, who's she's a meteoriticist, but in her own time, she's doing a certificate in Egyptology. And so she's been in touch with the people at the Petrie, and she's trying to persuade them to let her look more closely at these beads. So they're strung on a necklace, or two necklaces, here and here. And although you can't see it, here and here and here, 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 and there's one further up, are little cylinders of rolled metal. And there's only a very, very poor elemental analysis of them, which shows that they've got nickel in, so they are believed to be from a meteorite. The rest of the necklets are made from gold and some semi-precious gemstones, mainly carnelian. Now, this is the sketch that Wainwright and his sidekick, Bush Fox, made of this tomb. And there's a cluster of tombs, and this is actually tomb 76, I think, or 67, one of them. And you can see that there's the body here, bent, and it's facing... that must be north, so that's south. So it's facing to the west, and it has all these... west. And so there are all these other artifacts. There were daggers made of ordinary metal. This here is the skull, but it's not actually attached to the body. And it looks as if it's been decapitated. So there's the body is arranged in this way, and these necklets were around the neck, and there's a displaced vertebra, and then the skull, because the body's lying on its side, you'd expect the skull to be on its side, you know, ear to the ground. But it's not. It's been placed upright, and sand is around it. And when you read the description in this paper, which fortunately is in English because my French isn't particularly good, the description is that this skull is sort of sitting there and surrounded by sand, and the tomb hasn't been disturbed. It hasn't been plundered at all. So, you know, all the gold's still there, all the other bits and pieces. And it's now thought, and this is the skeleton of a young person. It doesn't say male or female, but I would assume, given all the grave goods, that it's a male. But they think that the skeleton is of somebody who is executed and decapitated. And what we're trying to do, Diane and myself, is to... she's going to contact the people in the Petrie so that we can try and look at some of these rock cylinders here. Okay, and the technique that Diane will use is using our electron microscope to determine how much nickel is there, because that's a characteristic of metallic of iron meteorites. But we have a technique whereby you can cut, you can use the beam of irons, to cut tiny, tiny pieces, so small. Diane's been down to the British Museum and shown them that actually you can cut a tiny little piece out of a coin or out of Egyptian grave goods, and even at high magnification you can barely see where that slice has come, because it's about 8 microns across. So we're hopeful that they might actually let us sample some of these so we can get a much better idea. And then if we have a better idea, knowing the type of meteorites that have been found from that area, we might be able to then match it to a particular meteorite find, which will then give you an idea of trade routes, things like that, because trade and commerce is very important in meteorites. Now, the other aspect of things is tools, and I don't know if you can see there, these are stolen from the Natural History Museum, their photo library. I was curator of the meteorite collection there for 14 years, and I could have photographed these any day I chose, but I never got round to it, and now I needed photographs of them, and I had to download them from their website. And these are specific blades that have been found in knives that were used by the Inuit of Greenland, Thule in northern Greenland. And this is an example of using hammered metal in places where metal deposits are not available. And this particular meteorite is called the Cape York iron meteorite. And it's a massive meteorite. In fact, it's several massive meteorites. And it was first came to people's attention in 1812. Now, this is not long after meteorites have been accepted as natural phenomena. And it was also a time of great exploration and travel. And John Ross was searching for the Northwest Passage. He was a captain in the British Navy. And he got as far as Thule in Greenland, and he was talking to people, and he heard that some of the Inuit, although I believe they were called Eskimos, and in his reports they're known as Eskimos, with E-M-I-S-Q-U-A-X, the way it was spelled. He talked to them, and he was very surprised that they had these bladed tools because there were no natural iron resources there. And they'd never traded with anybody. And so he acquired these. He traded with the Inuit and brought these knives back. And so it's hammered iron meteorite and whalebone is what they are. Each one is about that long. And they're on display in the Natural History Museum. Now, at the end of the 19th century, they found the Northwest Passage, and then the next thing to do was to find the North Pole. And an American explorer called Robert Peary was doing some of the exploration to search for the North Pole, and he did eventually reach the North Pole. But on his way there, he too stopped off at Thule, and he too talked to some of the locals. Now, by this time, they had started trading, and they were no longer reliant on this source of metal for their tools. So he traded, and the reports say he traded a gun for the location of where the metal was coming from. And this is 1894, and it took from 1894 to about 96. He went back each year, 94, 95, 96, to look for the source of this metal. Eventually, he was shown it. And there were three enormous masses. Anegito, which means the tent, weighs 30 tons. And there's Akpalilik, and I can't remember the Danish Greenland for the other one, but I mean the woman and the dog. So the tent is the biggest. Then, so that's 31 tons. The dog is half a ton, and I think the woman is 1.5 tons. And he exported these meteorites back to New York. And Anegito, the tent, is on display in the American Museum of Natural History, all 31 tons of it. Now, I'm sorry, I have got some pictures of the actual meteorite, but somehow the only one I've put into my PowerPoint presentation is when it was being brought back to New York. So you can see you've got this amazing train of horses dragging a sled along. I can show you a couple of other pictures, and I'll show you at the end if you're interested, because I didn't actually paste them into the PowerPoint presentation because I forgot about it. But I mean, there's a whole long saga about getting this 31-ton single boulder of metal from northern Greenland to New York. Because the first time he went, he had a ship, and they sort of dog-sledded it across Greenland to where the ship could park, or whatever his ships do, dock. And And then the sort of captain of the ship said, "Oh, no way, you know, you will sink my ship." So eventually, you know, 2 years later, he had a bigger ship and they brought it back to New York. But there are several very good descriptions of the travel, the journey of getting it to New York. So the last subject that I want to cover, and I've only got a couple of slides for this, is meteorites in commerce. Now, I said that meteorites have been used as items of trade for when they were tools. Now they are used in very, very different ways. They're used, you see, in jewellery. I've taken these prices from a website today, so $300 to $350 for a man's watch. This is from a meteorite called Gibeon, which is found in Namibia. And if you go to Namibia, if you go to Windhoek, the capital of Namibia, in the street, in the main square, in the road leading up to the main square, there are boulders of metal. And in the main square, there's a pile. And these are all great big chunks of this metal meteorite called Gibeon. And it's very, very widely traded. And it has a very, very fine Widmannstein pattern. And I mean fine in the sense of beautiful, and also fine in the sense of the needles, the lamellae are very, very thin. Beautiful, beautiful meteorite. And it's also been used, this is a custom designed, it's called Once in a Blue Moon, and it's in gold and platinum. And this is a sapphire, and it's price on application. I just could not find a price for it in New York. The people who sell the watches also sell rings. This is made of Gibeon, and this is just a regular ring of Gibeon. And to be honest, I wouldn't want to wear a ring made of iron meteorite because they do rust, right? You know, you're wearing metal, and so the regular ones that are just made of iron meteorite cost about $100-$200, but they do them set in silver gold, platinum, you know, you name it, and the prices, you know, really are astronomical. And these are two pendants as well from a different websites where you've got pieces of the stony irons being polished and held in gold and in silver. I don't know whether I approve of this. I really don't. I haven't got any meteorite jewellery myself. I've certainly never bought any myself. They are beautiful. It's undeniable that they are beautiful. And, you know, if people wear some meteorite jewellery and somebody else comes up to them and says, "Oh, that's unusual, what is it?" And, you know, the word gets out that, you know, meteorites are interesting and unusual and more people get to know about them, then that's fine. And things like Gibeon, which there's so much of, you sort of feel, well, you know, why not? Because they are really, really beautiful. But then I keep thinking, well, you know, they're scientifically valuable as well. But, you know, how much novel scientific value are you going to get from something that weighs, you know, that you've got 80 boulders which weigh 100 tonnes in total? It's like, you know, it's terribly difficult. And the idea of meteorites in commerce and trade is very difficult anyway. Because meteorites are now perceived as collectibles and they retain their value, you know, in the way people collect and buy all sorts of things, you know, artworks and stuff. And so there has been a big trade in meteorites because more and more meteorites have become available because they've been found in the Sahara Desert. And they can be brought out of the Sahara Desert. The locals in the Sahara Desert collect them and then they sell them. And you used to be able to go into the souk in Marrakesh and buy a sack of rock for a couple of dollars and you'd bring it back and, you know, you might have a meteorite in it. Now I think it's difficult to do that because certainly the Libyan government has sort of said, no, hang on a minute, you know, these are valuable, we want to keep them. Algeria, I don't think anybody in their right mind would go into Algeria at the moment. And in Morocco, again, there's now quite a strong group of people in Morocco who study meteorites. So it's the actual number of meteorites collected freshly is sort of slowing down a bit, but the actual number of meteorites that are on the world's markets is enormous. And because they are now becoming and seen as collectible, the price of them has gone up. So whereas you used to be able to buy gibbon for $1 a gram, it's now more like $10, $15, $20 a gram. Now that means that museums and national collections are becoming priced out of the market. So if a new meteorite falls, then immediately dealers who have got quite a lot of resources can go. You know, so there was a new meteorite fell in Finland a couple of years ago. Immediately, dealers went over there. Now for a national museum, you know, they have to fill in, you know, field work forms about health and safety and risk, and then they have to, you know, make a business case to get the airfare. And by the time they've done all that, you know, the dealers who've just hopped on an EasyJet flight, you know, they've scooped the pool. So it's makes it very, very difficult. What the academic community does have, though, on the dealers is that the International Meteoritical Society, which is an academic society, oversees the naming of meteorites. And if you've got a name, because they're named after where they're found or where they've fallen, you've given them a provenance. So the Meteoritical Society, once they're assured that the provenance of the meteorite is valid, they will give it a name. And that immediately gives the specimen a higher perceived market value. The most important thing, though, is that the condition of naming is that 20% of the specimen, or 20 grams, whichever is the lesser amount, is deposited in a recognised collection for scientific research. So this triangle I've got at the top, where you've got, you know, you've got a synergy between the academic, the dealer and the collector. You know, the dealers and collectors rely on the academics to give them the name, the provenance and an identification. And the academics, museum curators, rely on the dealers and the collectors to make material available. So, finally, thank you very much for your patience. In summary, meteorites were recognised as natural objects about 200 years ago. And the scientific part of my talk showed that they can yield information about different stages of solar system history and the evolution of planetary bodies, especially the Moon and Mars. I talked about how bombardment of the Earth by comets and asteroids brought water and organic molecules to the Earth, which was the feedstock of life. In the second part of my talk, I showed that meteorites have been recognised as being different from Earth rocks. And that has led to their veneration as religious objects. And just as a side here, I want to mention that in Mecca, there is a venerated stone, and it's called the Black Stone of the Kaaba. And for many, many years, it was thought to be a meteorite. Now, it's very, very difficult for Westerners, non-Muslims, to get a sight of that, and you know, the idea of trying to get some for analysis is would be an intrusion. But somebody was allowed a sight of it about 30 years ago, and he described it in a scientific paper as a serpentinite. So it's believed actually not to be a meteorite, but you know, we don't know for certain. But certainly it's an object of veneration. And I've also mentioned that meteorites have a commercial value as collectibles. But this is my last sentence. Meteorites are priceless in terms of their scientific value. Thank you very much.